From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Oi, everybody, welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys.
Oi!
Okay, we've got a couple of cunts here named John. You say, mate?
Howdy.
Right.
Not doing an accent today.
Okay. All right. We have a guy there, fucking, what's the section? What's your name, mate? Hunter.
Oi. This is Hunter. I'm slurping down some vinegar with my fish and chips, listening to Saxon, eh?
Yeah, I don't know why I listen to Saxon, mate. We're talking like the fucking Clash this week, mate.
Yeah,
Clash.
You know what I think? I think Rude Boys are a bunch of cunts.
Really?
That's what I think.
I like that fucking little cunt at the start. What's his name? That little skinhead Nazi kid. You know, he's fucking...
Oh,
he's hysterical,
mate. Gary Oldman.
Okay, three cunts. There's half the audience gone there. All right, so yeah. We're talking 90...
Oh, a bunch of cunts anyway.
There goes nine women listeners.
Yeah, nine female
and
listeners.
Oi, this is Britain. This is the UK, all right? Cunt is like saying hello.
I'd say about six or seven thin-skinned listeners in California.
Yeah.
And
California,
Portland, Oregon.
A bunch of poofs anyway.
Portland, Oregon, specifically white,
Portland,
white
Oregon.
Guys.
That Portlandia show—that's the biggest poofter show of all.
And maybe a couple of people in Cambridge. I don't know; they'll do too well with that.
Except one guy sitting there going, "Oh, he's laughing his ass off."
No, he's laughing.
I stabbed some cop from Cambridge the other day. I got a footy game.
All right, so we're talking the 1980 film Rude Boy with the Clash. Yeah, so Hunter and John are here, and myself and Stuart, for those of you who are just new to the show, if you've managed to get through the first 3 or 4 minutes without switching off, oh, you know what I think about... I'm just not going to do that side again. I'm not going to say that. I've done it once, that's enough. And, a film I've been wanting to talk about since, I think, even since this show started back in, was it 1963, I think, when we first started doing this show?
Yeah, 1967, or 1980, what is it?
Oh, I don't know. 1977!
1977!
Yeah, that's what it feels
like. I hope I go to heaven!
Yeah.
It's so lucky to be rich!
Sorry. Yeah. So anyway, this came about by me having seen this film numerous times over the years. And I'll give a quick backstory just shortly about how I managed to find or actually know about this film. But it came about by my starting to listen to The Clash again just very recently in the last... I think 2 weeks or so, just at work, just grabbed my pretty much all the Clash stuff I had in the garage, which is everything, except for that Cut the Crap album, which I was not very fond of.
Cut the Crap, that's the one without Mick Jones, so it's...
Yeah.
That's the band was kind of unraveled. I think Terry Chimes was, Topper Hedden was...
Gone.
Out, and Terry Chimes, I think, came back to fill in on the drums. You know, he played on the first record.
Yeah.
And so, like, the band, with Cut the Crap, the band was falling apart. I mean, I like This Is England. I think that's a pretty good song.
And We Are the Clash is very unique as well, yeah.
It's got some good songs, but the band was kind of done by that time.
So, anyway, who had seen this before? John?
I have.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
I saw it back in 98. I actually had to rent it from a Toronto video store and make a copy of it at a friend's apartment who worked at the video store.
Toronto? How the hell would you do live in Toronto now, did you?
No, I was just taking a vacation. I was just there for a week, and a friend had 2 VCRs and worked at Suspect Video, which was the hip video store in town. And Rude Boy was a pretty scarce title to find at that time. It wasn't something a lot of video stores were going to stock. This could literally be a segment of VHS days revisited.
Oh, whatever, God, yeah.
But yeah, I had a copy of it, and I was a little disappointed in it, actually, when I watched it. So
yeah, I can totally understand that, because it's going to throw you for a loop the first time you see it. Honey, you'd never seen it, I know.
No, never seen it.
Okay, no worries.
In fact, I can't believe I hadn't heard of it, because when I watched it, I was like, this is kind of a glorified Clash live video.
So you'd never even heard of it?
Nope, never heard of it till you brought it up.
Okay.
And there was a period where I was like reading a lot of magazine articles about the Clash and stuff, but it just kind of goes to the point John frequently makes about writers not knowing shit, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand.
Well, the interesting thing is, in America, the Clash, the whole retro love of the Clash or whatever, is really shrunk in the last couple of decades. Like, in the 80s, they were still talked about after they broke up, and literally in the last 12 years are almost forgotten as a major punk act. It's strange.
I think you're absolutely right, because, you know, when I first heard of the Clash, you know, I bought a bunch of their albums,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I think they're kind of almost, the Ramones are, you know, the Beatles of punk. They're kind of the Rolling Stones of punk. I don't know. Like,
well, they signed to CBS, and CBS put a lot into promoting them, got them opening for Springsteen when they toured America. You know, they got, the record company was actually behind them. And that's what happens if you sign a punk band and actually put money behind them promoting them. So thus the Clash became the most popular band in America out of the punk scene.
But like, there were just all these things I would find out that I'd never saw written about, like, oh, Joe Strummer did all these movie soundtracks. Oh, he was in a ton of movies. You know, he did a bunch of stuff that, like, you know, I would just kind of stumble upon.
Yeah.
I was like, why is this not talked to? And when I saw this movie, I was like, this is the Clash, like, in their prime. Like, Joe Strummer looks like he's had his teeth knocked out with a microphone. Like,
they're a bit gnarly.
You know, Mick Jones looks like he can't afford a haircut. You know, Topper Hedden looks like he hasn't discovered heroin yet. I was like, these guys all look great. You know, I was like, this is the early band, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
Why haven't I heard about this movie? I mean, this is a nice artifact of this band.
Because it's so unknown. That's the whole problem, even to this day. I mean, it's now with a DVD release that it's had over the last, nearly 10 years, I think it is. It's gained some sort of audience, but it's not one of those titles out there that's readily available. I mean, it's certainly not now.
There are a lot of titles that sort of gain notoriety that are unavailable, you know, that feature artists or something.
Well, the Clash disassociated themselves from it for some reason.
Well, yeah, they did. And when I read that just doing some quick reading on this movie. And I was wondering, like, why would they do that? Is it because they had friction with the filmmakers, or is it because we don't want to look like a band that's like, oh, yeah, we love this movie we're in. We're supposed to be a punk band, so we're going to be like, nah, fuck this movie that we were in, you know?
Yeah, there was, from the interviews I saw in the DVD, and while most DVDs, if you're a special features fan, you got to have the special features, but a lot of the time they're not necessary. With Rude Boy's DVD, the extras are absolutely necessary. You get an hour of interviews in there with Ray Gange, David Mingay, Jack Hazen, and Johnny Green, the roadie, from 2003 or 2004, I believe it was. And it's a very informative 1 hour. Nothing, like, you don't get any sort of information overlap from the four guys, so it's absolutely vital to get that DVD with all the special features on there, which I think is the British version and the Australian one. I don't think the American one has it. I think it's just the film and that's all it is. Plus, the DVD that I've got, which is the British import, came with that spanking 40-page book, which is outstanding in it. And it's just a treasure trove of information. Now, you were saying about, is there a possibility that the Clash disassociated themselves with this film because of the friction with the filmmakers? Yes, there was, as time wore on. This film was shot in 1978, but not released until 1980, so it was a two-year gap.
Well, it did feel like a lot of time passed, because it felt like the Clash changed their look throughout the movie.
Oh, Mick Jones. You only look at Mick Jones. He's got shortish hair and very long hair.
It just, by the time we were at the end, it felt like we went from self-titled Clash to London Calling Clash.
It was. Yeah, it really was. And a lot of friction had started up between the filmmakers and the band, because they were just getting tired of everything, and Ray Gange was saying that he was stuck in the middle of it all. You know, being the actor in the film, very reluctantly being the actor, he didn't want to be in this film whatsoever.
He wrote it, though, right? Or was he?
Nope, he didn't write it either. They stuck his name in the credits so that if they ever got any flack for the content in there, it'd deflect onto him being the younger guy, because David Mingay and Jack Hazen were a lot older at the time.
For some reason I was thinking it was like his movie or something.
No, he didn't write a stitch of the film whatsoever, apparently. he may have come up with some things, but there was nothing that he actually laid down on paper as a credited writer. He was just credited as a writer for this. So yeah, it was shot over a 2 year or an 18 month period, and a lot had changed by that time. Getting over my first time I saw this film, I first noticed this film in 83 at a video store called Leiden Records. And I remember Leiden exactly how it was. You'd go through the door, and right in the middle of the store, as you walk through the door, in the middle of the store was the counter. You veer off to your left, it was Vinyl Records. To the right was your VHS store. And I remember being in the VHS store with my dad and looking around, and I just came across this title, Rude Boy. I'm like, wow. And it was rated R, which at the time, well, still today, is the highest, you know, rating you can get, like an 18 in the UK or a NC-17 in the US. So I was always drawn down, like, oh, wow, rated R. And I flipped the back of the cover of the VHS. I've never, ever found this tape again. I wish I had known. I would have bought it back then, you know, like, used or something. But on the back of the cover was this girl flipping off, this punk girl with a mohawk flipping off the camera, who doesn't even appear in the film whatsoever, but she was on the video box. And just for some reason, that image stuck with me. I can still picture it now, like 25, 30 years later, I can still picture it. Yeah, it just left a real lasting impression on me. Just that image of that punk girl with her mouth open, screaming and flipping off the camera. So, but of course, I was too young to rent it out. Like, and there's no way Dad's going to rent out a film called Rude Boy to a 11, 12-year-old kid at the time. Why the film was rated R, now I'll look at it and I think, well, I really don't know why. It'd be language, obviously, back then.
Yeah,
that would be about it.
Well, there's a blowjob scene that would probably...
That's true. That blowjob scene did seem kind of full-on. It wasn't explicit, but it seemed kind of like... seems like something's happening there.
Realistic enough where it'd get an NC-17.
And there's the sex shop stuff.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, but you barely...
Well, you got anything hotter? Got something with black girls, you know?
Yeah, but you don't really see anything in there that's classed as hardcore porn, you know?
It's the implication if
you haven't seen it. It's implied. Yeah, it's all implied, you know, that... But anyway, so you go on years and years. I never see the film. Then I'm in a second-hand store here, and I'm just looking for the VHS tapes, and fuck me, there's the British UK videotape of Rude Boy just sitting on the shelf for like $10, I think it was, or $18 tonight. And I just... one of those moments I've mentioned back in VHS memories where my hands started shaking, like, oh, I've got to have this fucking tape now. So I picked it up and went and bought it. And I can't remember if I was driving up. No, I would have been... I caught a bus home, and where the store was located was...
Ah, man, I wanted you driving a Ford Falcon.
No, not then. Didn't quite have my license then. I got my license a lot later. So I caught a bus back, and from where I was getting it from was the east, over east. And I lived over west at the time, so it was a long ass haul back home. I just remember the anticipation of just fucking just watching this film, and I popped it in. Like, when I got home, I'm like, man, I really like it, but I don't get it.
Right.
So I was probably like you, John, the first time around, like, you were kind of underwhelmed or disappointed by it.
Right. Well, it also had a lot of underground hype and punk rock scenes and stuff. Like, it was this must-see, as if it was the best concept film you never saw. And, you know, and a lot of it is two-camera shooting of very rough, handheld two-camera stuff of the stage shows and everything. And it's not... there's no overdubs on the music. I don't think the soundtrack was clean.
Nah, it's all organic. Yeah,
it's like, very live, as is.
Yeah.
You know what it kind of reminded me of was Wild Style. And that's because, like, it had a story, but I didn't really give a shit about the story, but I liked the music, and I kind of liked the scene it captured. Like, with Wild Style, you had the early New York hip-hop scene. Like, that's the stuff that makes the movie memorable to me.
Yeah.
With Rude Boy, you get that sort of early, that early Clash concert footage, which I was totally enraptured by, and just loved seeing a young Clash play, and, you know, fairly well shot, you know, just seeing Joe Strummer, like, you know, just kind of shaking while he plays, and you know, all that stuff. And seeing, you know, there's like it just sort of seemed like a Clash concert movie with an incidental you know, sort of drama thing constructed around
it. Like a kitchen sink drama, you know.
Right, like it felt like a Ken Loach type thing. Or
it was like one of those Mike Lee movies.
Mike Lee, yeah.
Without any real script, you know.
It was like, oh, we're going to go to the... There's a protest for the National Front. Like, yeah, let's go film it. And, okay, here's a Clash concert. Let's go film it. And we'll have this guy walking around who will be sort of the anchor for it. Kind of like the graffiti artist was for Wild Style, even though that guy was an actual... Yeah, again, it was capturing another cultural element.
Yeah.
But... Yeah. But it did sort of remind me of Wild Style, where it had stuff like the stuff in Wild Style, like I didn't really care about the plot. I liked all the culture around it. With Rude Boy, I like all the culture around it. Not the plot, like I didn't really follow it. I didn't really care, you know.
It's not really there. There's really like, not much plot.
You know, occasionally I paid attention to like him and Joe Strummer like clashing on politics just because it was kind of funny.
Oh, I find that stuff intriguing. I really do.
Yeah, I thought it was just kind of funny because whenever I look at European politics, and you know, take this in the spirit in which it's intended, but it always seems so extreme to me. You're either a fascist or a commie, you know.
Like, right.
You can't. There's nowhere in the middle, and I always hear like Europeans going like, "Oh, American politics is so weird. It's so backward." But I'm like, yeah. I don't know. European politics. It's like it's either you are like a pinko communist, or you're a Jew killing, you know, black hating. You know, right winger. You know, it's one of the two. You know, like yeah. You can't have any middle ground at all. And even like politicians who do reside in the middle get painted with either extreme brush. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just it's one of those things that's always kind of fascinated me and made me shake my head about European politics.
Yeah, I like it for the fact also it shows the birth of Thatcherism in London and in England. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. You do get a lot of footage of Margaret Thatcher in this.
You do. Yeah, I think was she just sworn in at that time? Was it 78? She was just
yeah.
Sworn
I mean,
in.
It had to be early because she looked young.
It would have been during the filming, I think.
Yeah, you it know, was.
There was that bit where she gave the speech about cracking down on crime, and there were just some little bits here and there where, and you also had the National Front, and you also had the kind of communist groups walking around and. You had Joe Strummer talking about how he's for the left, and this kid was like, "I don't know, I'd maybe rather be for the right." And, you know?
Yeah. You want the expensive cars and the maids.
I want to be the guy. I want to fucking make sure I'm the guy in the black car, mate.
Yeah, and not out fucking walking.
Yeah. Not out fucking walking.
I've seen this film.
Joe Strummer's like, "Well, the left, you know, it's for everybody. You know, yeah. It's not just for the guy in the black car." He's like, "Yeah, but I want to be the guy in the black car, mate."
You know what the one
because
thing...
at the end of the day, there's always going to be somebody in the black car. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's it. But the thing I've seen this film so many times, and it grew. I mean, I just think now I'll leave my judgment, but it's not hard to work out what I think of this film. But I've seen this thing about 12 times now, and I watched it for the first time ever up on the big screen upstairs. I projected it up there, and I was like, "Wow, man, this really blew my mind." Because the DVD looks really, really good projected. And I just because I've always ever just seen it like on a smaller screen or a VHS tape, which is full frame, and I just thought it was great. But I requested this film a few weeks back. Because I wanted to get an American's point of view on politics, like the British politics, which mirror a lot of Australian's politics, obviously with the Commonwealth, and just like an American point of view on everything British, which is obviously with you guys, and especially with Hannah more so often because he's so much younger than us, than John and I. What would you come away with this in the end? What'd you think?
Me specifically, like I mean, again, as I said earlier, I thought it was kind of funny how extreme all the politics are. You're either a communist or you're a fascist, you know? I've just always thought, like, European politics and British politics were painted with a very extreme brush. And even though I don't think everybody's communist or fascist, it seems like people with right or left beliefs get painted with the communist or fascist brush.
But it's also the culture as well I'm talking about at the time, because you weren't raised through the 70s like John and I were, and yes, while we're in different countries to Britain, it was still a part of that time. What did you first of all, did you even like this? Did it strike a chord with you somewhere apart from,
well,
I know you like the music of the Clash. I mean, it's, to anybody this anybody who says that they think the performances in this film by the Clash are subpar is a liar or an idiot, because I think they're the best I've ever seen captured
by
anywhere.
Well, they need to go watch the Katy Perry halftime show at the Super Bowl, because I think that's more their speed. But
yeah, no, I honestly think the performances by the Clash in this are best I've seen by any band anywhere.
I was mad that nobody had told me about this movie beforehand because of the Clash performances. Because and plus, it reminded me of what a great band the Clash are. I mean,
absolutely.
Like I watch it and I'm like, okay, you got Joe Strummer, you got his vocals, you got Mick Jones providing kind of the harmonizing vocals and the kind of ska guitar licks. You've got Paul Simon on kind of complimenting everything with his bass playing, which is something bass players don't often do anymore.
He's a solid bass player, that guy.
I mean, I think like when I listen to great bass players, the bass seems to complement the guitar playing rather than just hold the bottom end down.
Yeah,
because I think so many bass players today are just a waste of space. They're just it's just a guy on the payroll.
Yeah.
You know,
they're forgotten in the digital recording era.
Yeah, it's
CDs could never really capture the depth of bass until like recent years when they started doing 24-bit. So I think that's why it's just kind of a forgotten element these days.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, but so like, you know, Paul Simonon's one of those great bass players who adds depth to it. And, you know, Topper's drumming. I was just watching it. It just made me remember, because I haven't listened to The Clash consistently for a few years.
Yeah.
You know, I went through a period where I listened to The Clash over and over again, and I still listen to a few Clash songs here and there.
Yeah.
From time to time, but that made me go, like, gosh, I want to go dig back into my Clash records, you know, and listen to London Calling and Give Them Enough Rope and Super Black Market Clash all over again.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But I found, I mean, I dug through the whole catalog, and I even trawled through Sandinista, which was tough, because I just...
Sandinista's pretty rough. I don't like that album very much.
No. But their style changed drastically, and that's the thing, like, people who would know The Clash casually would say, oh, yeah, Rock the Casbah, or should I stay or should I go, or London Calling, but what they're going to get is none of those songs in this film.
This is all early Clash.
Oh, like, this is... Yeah.
You get a little bit from London Calling, and that's it. Like, as far as, like, you know, that's as late as it gets, you know.
Do you even get any part of London Calling in there?
You get Rudy Can't Fail.
Rudy Can't Fail wasn't written for London Calling. It was an old song. No, it wasn't even written for the film.
Well, it was the version that appears on London Calling.
It is, but it was recorded earlier. Remember, this film came out in 1980, but the song was actually written, according to the notes I've got in my... Clash on Broadway box set, Strummer said for this song that it wasn't even written for the film, because Rude Boy, you know, if I remember correctly, is nothing to do with Ray Gange in this film, who's known as Ray in the movie. It's actually a Jamaican term.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, a rude boy. And hence the term Rudy Can't Fail has nothing to do with Ray either. It's about... it's actually about the black pickpockets and the actual story.
Well, what are y'all's favorite Clash songs, by the way? What's your favorite Clash song?
I'm so bored with the USA.
That's a great one. Stu?
White Man, the Hammersmith Palais, I think is fucking brilliant.
Oh, that's a deep choice. Because I nearly shat my pants with excitement when they played Safe European Home.
Yeah,
I love that song so much, because it almost feels like the song the Clash wrote when they went to Jamaica and went, oh fuck, we're getting robbed.
Exactly.
Like, we came here like loving your music, and all you want to do is rob us.
Exactly.
Like, I went to the place where every white face was an invitation to robbery.
I think 10cc like, didn't 10cc write a song as well, like that back in what was that bloody song? I don't like cricket. I can't remember the actual title of the track. It's lost to me at the moment. But anyway, yeah, White Man Hammersmith Palais. I really like Guns of Brixton as well, even though
Guns of Brixton is great. That was one of the songs that made me fall in love with The Clash, was that song.
Yeah, because that's all about... well, they do reference The Harder They Come in there, that's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we sort of synopsize this sort of thing for the audience out there and let them know. It's based around Ray Ganj, known as Ray in the movie, who apparently didn't want to be known as, who had he seen the film, he said later on, didn't want to, would never have used his real name in there, who works at a sex shop in Soho, and...
You got anything harder?
Yeah.
Black women.
What you want, mate? Domination, black women. Having worked in a fucking sex store, believe me, that resonated with me big time. it really did. But I never drank beer in the shop, believe me, if I could.
I love how Ray, like, it reminded me of watching the Alice Cooper documentary, Super Duper Alice Cooper.
I've still not seen it.
For the first half, every single archival film strip of Alice Cooper has him drinking a beer like that. Like, for a long time, like, they talk about Alice's alcoholism.
Yeah.
But it doesn't come as a surprise because he's drinking like a can of Miller High Life. Like, the entire, every single shoot, shot, like, photograph, film strip, Alice is drinking a beer. And when I was watching this, I was like, every shot, Ray's nursing a tall one, you know?
Yeah, special brew, yeah. Which is supposed to be like one of those malt liquors that we saw in Memphis Hunter. Especially akin to that.
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. That's very... That's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you go to Wild Bill's and all they sell is 40 ounces, you know?
Yeah. So Ray works in a sex shop in Soho. He's kind of just lumbers throughout the film, you know, going out to clash
gigs. He's on public assistance.
Yeah, yeah. He's on the dole. Always. Yeah. Which is good when you see him open up his doll check from Her Majesty, and it's for like £13, and it's got career opportunities playing in the background. That was
career opportunities.
Yeah, and he gets a call up one day from Johnny Green, who comes into the store. He wants to get a job roadieing with the Clash, but there's nothing available at the time. Well, Joe Strummer.
So do I. Get in line, dick.
So Joe Strummer says, "What you gonna do? You see my point."
I've got nothing to give you. You know, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So anyway, they have the Rock. I like that. One of my favorite scenes in the whole film was the whole Rock for Racism outdoor festival, because that was all real, apparently. The part where they had the Clash playing White Right, and they had Jimmy Percy from, what was it, Sham 69, I think he was in, singing with them. And then they cut the power or something like that, and then they had David Mingo, the filmmaker, sent Ray out. I think you see him pushing Ray out onto the stage. That was all real, about Ray going up there and going, "You want more Clash?" And that long-haired promoter, who was a real guy, who was not an actor, came on. Ray's going, yeah, "Fuck him! More Clash!" But the thing about him getting beaten up after the thing by the promoters, or what would he say? "See what those fucking anti-Nazi cunts did." You know, he sees black boy. Yeah. I told you, I've seen this a ton of times, mate. That was never real, the black boy.
I almost want dialogue samples to play throughout our episode.
Yeah. This is one of those things where I want drops, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I'll have more time to do it. So he gets offered... So Johnny Green, the actual roadie for the Clash, comes in and offers him a gig to come tour with him throughout, Europe, I think it was, or Scotland or something like that.
This is Glasgow, mate.
Yeah, he takes it up, and let's just say Ray's not very good as a roadie. He's good.
All he does is get drunk.
He's good at nicking the band's beer and stuff and hanging around and talking in their ear, but setting stuff up.
Talking about politics. Talk about politics in your music. It annoys me.
Yeah. It's still in the band's beer, but putting things up and taking them down, he's not so hot. And, it's like a documentary with slices of, staged or scripted
It's a docudrama,
yeah. Pretty much.
Like Pumping Iron or something like that.
Pretty much. If you're going to put in percentages, I'd feel that this is probably about a 75% documentary, 25% drama. So he goes on tour with the Clash, and it basically just follows him touring with them and getting beaten up. And
I will say I got tired of the song White Riot when I was watching this movie.
Oh, look, it's played a lot of times throughout the film.
It's played a lot.
It is, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It was like California Dreamin' in Chungking Express.
Yeah, okay. Can't say I've seen that, but one of the faults. Yeah, one of the faults I've got with this film is I think that they portrayed the Clash, save for Joe Strummer, to be kind of like bullies a bit, which for a band with a left wing attitude really sort of struck me as odd. Like Mick Jones comes across as a miserable individual, like the sort of guy I would not want to approach. He just seems unbelievably miserable. Well, apparently, he was like that in real life. Wasn't very friendly. Either liked him. He either liked Jerry Hager. There was no sort of middle ground with him. And the bit at the end, when they're before they pour, they put Ray in the bathtub and pour water over him, cold water over him. We got Paul and Topper, you know, tripping him up, and you know, even though Ray's drunk, which is a lot of the film Ray's drunk in. it just really seemed odd. It just like it stuck out, and I'm like, oh, you know, you could have really lost that scene of them tripping him up and sort of bullying him. Just it didn't look good.
I don't know. I thought Ray kind of seemed like a drunk asshole, and they were just kind of sick of him. You know.
Oh, look, you know, that may have been the case, but
like I was kind of like, they're just kind of tired of this shit. You know.
Yeah. And then you got the whole subplot with the black pickpockets, which David Mingay tries to explain in the interview he gives on the DVD special features, and it makes some. It's sort of like a mirror of Britain, how it is for blacks, how repressed blacks were in Britain at the time, but it doesn't really translate through in the whole film.
No, it didn't really come through.
It didn't.
I was like, what's going on here?
If you weren't familiar with like the whole political scene in England at the time and the turmoil and everything, you're going to be kind of lost watching it.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Because I was a bit like, okay, obviously this is some political stuff I'm not aware of, or just on, or it's been years since I read that John Savage book, England's Dreamin', so I just don't remember any of this stuff.
And England's Dreamin'.
Right, it's like, because there's so much, and it seems like in England, when you look at it in movies and documentaries, they just went through stuff like every few months there was some sort of major political upheaval. And unlike America, where riots are actually pretty rare, like it seemed like in England there was always like this shit going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's more compact. It's like the way punk rock took over the British mainstream like right away. And in America, it was always like a fringe thing and an underground thing. And it's like, but in England, it was like, you know, what, Sex Pistols have a song banned, and then it's the number one song that week. That was unheard of.
When the Sex Pistols came to America, they were playing like bowling alleys and stuff.
Well, they were treated like crap. Like when bands like Talking Heads or Ramones toured, if they had the punk label on them, like radio stations would actually say, "Oh, one of these punk bands is playing down the night." Like they treated them like an enemy.
Like what was it? The Sex Pistols said, like, I've heard Steve Jones talk about touring in America with the Sex Pistols. He said it was miserable. Like, he said nobody, and they would all just kind of get...
It ruined them. It broke them up again, yeah. It ruined them. That was it, that North American tour. Well, that was it. That was their last one. They split. Wasn't Johnny... Yeah. Johnny Rotten just basically left and said, fuck it, gone. Yeah. Sid hung around and
McLaren
died.
Wasn't paying them. Yeah. McLaren just wasn't paying them. He wasn't giving them shit. You know, he's totally exploiting them. That's a totally forgotten aspect there.
It's interesting as well, the fact that never translated over to America, the whole British punk. I mean, if you look at footage, if you go back to the Filth and Fury and the Fury documentary of the Sex Pistols, you just look at Americans and they're just dumbfounded. They don't know what to make of it.
They said like it was a lot of like bikers like just staring at them, going, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, in Britain, it was totally like, they got it. In some of the National Front scenes as well, you know, the filmmakers filming the crowd outside the Clash. Did you see that one kid looked like he was about maybe 14, with spit hanging out of his mouth? That punk kid.
Yeah. didn't one of the guys in the Clash, was it Mick Jones or Strummer that got like hepatitis C when a fan like spat, like his gob actually went into his mouth?
Jesus. Oh, I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I heard about
one of them. One of them got hepatitis C. I can't remember which one, but dude, it's because of an incident with a fan.
Jesus.
Yeah, a lot of the American punk bands said that they fucking hated touring in the UK and Europe because the British fans would spit on them.
Well, British punk and then American punk was so different. If you look at bands at the time, like you look at The Clash, I'm talking about musically, look at The Clash around 78, 79, right? They just released their first album, getting into releasing Give Them Enough Rope. But you look at, you come across over the shore and you see the band like the Dead Kennedys. Mm-hmm. We were completely different in style. Yeah,
completely.
Yeah. And, I mean, you wouldn't really class Ramones as a punk band. They're more like a,
I think the
they don't have the punk ethos, you know?
The punk movement that sort of took cues from the Ramones didn't come till the Orange County punk bands in the 90s, you know? In the late 80s, early 90s, you know?
Later in the late 70s, so like Black Flag and
Minor Threat.
Yeah. Well, like, it was the sort of, like, but the Ramones had such a pop sensibility to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, the OC, the Orange County, like, pop punk bands sort of felt more like Ramones fans, even though they're not as good as the Ramones. It sort of felt like that same sort of ethos, like, we're making punk, aggressive pop music, you know?
It's just fast pop.
Although the Buzzcocks in the UK, I thought, actually sounded more like very Ramones-inspired. Like, it's actually pop songs with rather kind of cynical lyrics or, you know, punky lyrics or whatever. But I thought the Buzzcocks were more inspired by the Ramones than, say, the Pistols or the Clash.
Yeah. And you got other bands as well, which are just crap, like the Exploited, which I just fucking hated. Oh, that was just stupid.
I bought their CD, like, in the late 80s because it's like, you know, you could still find those in stores. Like, this was British punk.
Yeah, yeah.
And they you couldn't find references to them in books or anything, so I'd buy them. It was the most unlistable garbage.
It was ever. Shit. Did they have that?
It was like, oi, 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 oi.
Did you have that one with that track, Big Women, on it? That was hysterical.
Probably
Big Women!
Did.
I love them all! Big Women!
What about the Anti-Nowhere League?
Never listened to them.
Never listened to them.
So what? I even sucked an old man's cock, so what?
No, God.
So what? So what? So
they only came to the forefront because of Metallica. That was it.
Exactly.
Apart from that, one fucking knew about it. I mean, they were like a small underground thing.
Yeah. I remember Metallica covering that song and going, what the fuck?
I do remember one band called Chaotic Discord from the, mid to late 80s. And they had I think this album came out about 88 or 89. It was called Very Fucking Bad. And it had a piss take of Michael Jackson's Bad, the cover was. It was... The album was fucking awful, though. I've heard it's terrible. But the reason why we're talking about bands like The Exploited and Chaotic Discord is because I was not a fan of that hardcore punk. I just
thought
it was fucking stupid. Screwdriver as well. Just fucking stupid, the whole lot of them.
Gnostic Front, all that garbage.
Front had some great songs.
Yeah, I did see Gnostic Front live. I actually enjoyed them.
And plus, Peter Steele wrote the song Public Assistance for them.
Take their public assistance.
Well, there's another band who had really, really punk sort of attitude was Carnivore.
Oh, Carnivore was... Carnivore was very punk, and, like, what's funny was Peter Steele's lyrics for Agnostic Front and for Carnivore prompted, like, a lot of, like, Jello Biafra wrote an angry editorial in Maximum Rock and Roll.
Oh, God. What's
about,
new?
about Agnostic Front's public assistance.
I picked up a couple of Dick Kennedy's.
Agents as corporations.
But, like, Carnivore was so, like, violently politically incorrect. Like, they had songs like Male Supremacy, Jesus Hitler.
Yeah.
Jesus Hitler is one of my favorites. And I say that as a Catholic. I just love that.
Hail my fellow Nazo licks.
That was all for shock.
Swear to the holy swastika fix.
That whole extreme left, like, oh, God. Like I brought up that stupid band Heads Kicked Off, you know, when we spoke about them in the summit. It was an un-fucking watchable, unlistenable piece of shit they were. Because, you know, you felt like you were at a fucking socialist meeting, mate, instead of a concert or a gig, you know. But getting back to Rude Boy, what else did you guys take from this? You know, was there anything that really struck, apart from the music? The music is the obviously prominent part of the film. For instance, what do you think of the exchange between Ray and that little Nazi skinhead kid who said he was Joe's cousin, who was clearly not Strummer's cousin? He was just some guy they shoehorned in the film because it was amusing. You're talking about that whole
thing. It was one of those things where I was probably sitting there the whole time just trying to wonder if it was scripted or improvised.
Yeah, I was kind of.
Because that movie blurred that line so much, like. And because I'm more conscious of these things at my age, having seen all the stuff I've seen, I'm like, did they just rope this kid out and just have him like improvise this whole dialogue? Like, the questions I kept asking myself, like, what was real and what was, you know, staged for the cameras and stuff.
Well, that's the whole thing. I think obviously the whole anti-Nazi thing was, you know, was certainly a big part of the film. That's why you see at the start when Ray's looking out the window and he's watching the fireworks, you know. And and then he's walking down the stairs and he saw all these, you know, scribblings on the wall, and one of them's of a KKK guy with a hood, and says, "This is what you call a bad man, you black cunt," is written on there. So obviously it's setting the tone for the whole film.
Right.
And obviously with the National Front protests, they were pretty fucking violent, those things to watch, considering they were not staged or anything. They were the actual things. They just grabbed a camera and you know, basically film those things.
John, those were not racists. They were race realists.
It's funny. the funny thing is looking, like, watching that stuff now and not knowing too much about it, because back in the 70s, my only knowledge of England would be, like, Hammer films and Benny Hill. that's how I was viewing England, other than seeing footage of, like, Thatcher's rise on CNN or whatever. Like, that's all I knew about him.
So your limited knowledge of England back in the 70s is the limited knowledge you have of Australia in 2015. Okay. Well, it's
pretty
nice to see
much, because you're just Mad Max and Yahoo Serious.
Yeah, that's right.
The Proposition.
Yeah, yeah, that as well.
There is some cop show that was on my Netflix queue. I don't know if they took it off, but I think...
What was that?
Some Australian cop show about, like, the crime in Australia. And I'm thinking it was fiction.
There's one on...
Was that Underbelly?
Yeah, yeah.
That's not... Well, if you... No, that's not fiction. No, watch it. But if it's the first Underbelly, just one called Underbelly, I can promise you that's all real.
Thor. That's a good Australian...
Okay, now you're just being an idiot, so... Yeah. God. But yeah, I really like the performances in this. The fact that it was actually the stuff shot just after the first album came out and while they're recording Give Enough Rope.
I also like that Topper is credited as Nicky Hedden.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he just joined the band at the time.
Yeah. It seemed that way.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I find with this film, even when I watch it, it's 2 hours and 8 minutes. It's a long running length, but I don't get bored of it. And for the amount of times I'd seen it,
I watched it in two sittings. I watched an hour and then an hour.
I watched it last night on my 32-inch upstairs LED TV.
So yeah,
what did jump out is I could see all these details I could not see on the old video version.
Yeah, for a film that's not as wide, it's like just a standard Academy shooting. It does give a lot of stuff on the sides that you do miss on the VHS. I did notice that.
Right, also clearer. Like, I could read the graffiti and everything. Like, the print that was on the old video that I had access to was really muddy.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, it was one of those old, like, real blurry VHS transfers.
Crappy master.
Not really good at all. This actually had color correction and stuff, so I was like, okay. Like, I'm making out these details, and these Clash performances look much better. Like, it really, like, just seeing that crowd going crazy in the background, like, and realizing how big punk was in England compared to America.
Oh, yeah.
Where the Ramones are playing to, like, you know, a dozen people at a nightclub, and these guys are playing to, like, a, you know, huge, huge crowds that most bands in America can't even draw.
Yeah.
These days. And,
yeah, I was thinking about that. Stunning. I was like, that's like, that, like, some of the Clash shows I saw, I was like, that's a good night for, like, a pretty decent sized band.
Yeah.
Like, a band with a big following. If they can pull a crowd like that, they're doing pretty good.
I know. Today. It's just like it's changed the way I think we even view music, and that could be the impersonal thing of the iPod and the MP3 and all that shit. But it's like, yeah, back then, like, you loved your band. You were obsessed with them and followed them around England or whatever. And, you know, and they were appealing. There was a huge audience for that stuff there.
Well, you still, get people doing that now with Kiss.
Yeah.
You really do. You still get people seeing
it. It's true. It is true.
Yeah. I mean, as much as people make fun of Kiss, I mean, they've still got that loyal following all 40 years on where people will just go and follow them. They'll go see them in their Vegas residency, and then they'll go follow them up to Chicago or wherever they're playing. You've got to admire that.
Talk to any Kiss fan. They talk about them like they're the Beatles, you know.
Right.
They really do, you know, because there's still that that love, that connection with the group, which these days, as John was saying, with the MP3 and stuff, and you can basically just go to, like, you can say, Deep Purple's playing in town tonight, don't want to go because I know tomorrow I can go on YouTube and someone's filmed the whole concert and put it up there, like they did with Sabbath. When they were here, like the next day, the concert was up on YouTube. And okay, the experience of being at the concert can be the watching on your computer. Night and day difference, obviously.
Totally different. Yeah.
But
I don't even look at those fan film things.
No, but also with the advent as well with the rock concert. You know, it seems like it's one a week. Some bands releasing a rock concert, you know, on to buy on Blu-ray, and there's no real sort of incentive to go out and see a band. Also, ticket prices these days, I mean, I don't know what they're like in the US, but they're here, they're not...
They're crazy.
Oh, really?
Okay. It depends on the group. Like, it does. You know, I went to go see Devin Townsend, and it was $20. But
see, that's good.
I saw Gwar for free. I didn't even have to pay to see Gwar.
You shouldn't have to.
Yeah, but...
Is that after Dave Brocky's death or before?
Yes, it was. It was the first tour after he died.
See, why the fuck would you pay to see Gwar without Dave there? There's no
well, point. But you know what, though? The show they put on was one of the best I've ever seen. It was amazing.
I think I paid $19 to see Living Color last year, which that's not bad at all for a band that was once pretty big.
Not bad for a band who's got Vernon Reid in there, who's one of the biggest a-holes on the planet, apparently.
But, like, if you're going to go see a band in a club like that, even a really big club, it's probably going to run you $20. If you're going to go to, like, a venue like, you know, like American Airlines Center here in Dallas or Gex Energy Pavilion, places like that that are for much bigger acts, you're going to pay a lot more if you want decent seats, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. You pretty much know as soon as you see the auditorium where it's being
like when I went to whenever stuffed. I go to Mayhem Fest, I would pay like $100 to be right up in the front.
Yeah, but you're getting a shit ton of bands there, so
you're yeah, really no, that's the thing worth. Is there like I'd see Motorhead, I'd see Slayer, you know, and I'd be right up at the front, you know.
Yeah,
but you know, that's kind of different. But
yeah, sure, yeah. But we're talking about the experience of actually seeing the band these days has been lost.
Right.
People can say, well, I know I can get an audio rip of the actual concert somewhere through one of these torrent sites or these sites they know where to go to, these kids. Or they can wait for a YouTube listing on the whole thing.
But, like, you know, I for the kind of bands I like, you know, I like a lot of metal bands, a lot of prog rock bands, a lot of kind of punk type stuff, you know, a lot of stuff. I'm only going to pay $20 ever to see those kinds of groups.
Right.
We only paid $20 to see Rush. I'd pay a bit more than that.
No, I'm sure for Rush, for that tour, I'm probably going to pay a little bit more.
Yeah.
But I really want to see, because I've never seen Rush live. So.
No, neither have I.
So, you know, I'd like to go because they're saying this is probably going to be their last big tour. Not their last tour, but their last, like, well, extensive tour.
I'll tell you what you do. If you want to get in for free to Rush, there's a good way. Just shave your goatee off, right? Put a shirt, some slacks, and some pens in your pocket. And just say you're a university student. Tell me if I'm fucking MIT or something, and they'll let you in for free.
What I think, by the way, Neil Peart is apparently writing sci-fi novels with Kevin J. Anderson now.
Oh, my God.
He has a book coming out based on Clockwork Angels that he's writing.
Oh, wow, because my friend Mike Barron, I think, is buddies with Kevin J. Anderson.
Yeah, it's Neil Peart and Kevin J. Anderson are doing a Clockwork Angels book, The Last Brick album.
Well, I think Anderson is like some libertarian type of sci-fi writer or something.
Well, that makes sense because, you know, Neil Peart's lyrics are very Ayn Rand-ish type stuff.
Yeah.
Right, right.
All right. Who wants to wrap this up? Who wants to give a rating? Wrap you up in fish and chips, you cunt.
Should I give it a rating because I'm the...
I'd like to know what you think about it. What you think, mate?
Oh, what I think? I think I'd give it an 8. You know, like, the drama and the sort of story around it was kind of incidental to me.
Yeah.
But it was such a treat to see the Clash in their prime playing.
All right, let me ask you this. Because it's so heavy with the Clash's performances in there, strip away the performances, what else do you give it? What do you give it as a side rating?
Well, you know, I'm not going to go very low because I did find, like I said earlier, I did find the politics interesting.
Mm.
Like it did seem like an interesting snapshot. Without the performances, it's really not much to me, though. I'd rather watch, like, I think Meantime is a movie with similar themes that's better.
Yeah.
You know, like, Meantime is also it's about, like, kids on the dole and, you know, you know, the Thatcher 80s, you know.
That's every British movie.
Yeah, I know, right?
But,
but it has a great performances from a very young Tim Roth and a very young Gary Oldman.
Yeah.
They all have Tim Roth and Gary Oldman. They're all about being on the dole.
Yeah, but in most
movies... And having
movies,
bad teeth.
In most movies, though, Gary Oldman's like a crazy terrorist or something. Right. You know,
no, this one, he's a crazy skinhead. Coxie.
Coxie. Oi.
That is a film.
Smashing light bulbs in the movie.
That is a film I've seen, honestly, about 40 times. No shit.
I saw it because of you.
Yeah.
You fixed it to me.
Yeah, that's a film we've got to talk about one day, man. Meantime.
Yeah. We got to do a show on that sometime.
Absolutely.
But, like, you know, it's kind of like a lesser version of something like that. But without the Clash performances, it wouldn't be as interesting to me, probably.
Yeah, I understand that. See,
But I did like seeing, like, the political stuff because it made me kind of go, like, you know, this is kind of... It kind of reinforced what I kind of thought and my visions of Europe at the time.
Yeah.
Of England, I should say.
Yeah. Okay. All right, John.
I give it probably a 6, and it pretty much all of that rating is going for the Clash performances, because I don't really care much for the Clash beyond Give Them Enough Rope. Like, I only really like the first two albums.
That's because you're a racist and you hate reggae music because it's played by black people.
as I look at my 25 gigabytes of Trojan Records box set that are my hard drive.
I have the story of Trojan Records box set.
I have, like, all of them. I found, like, a torrent file. I had everything, and I'd been collecting them. It's too expensive, so I found a file.
Any Pedatosh in there at all? I like Pedatosh.
Could be. Yeah. But it'd be like Trojan Records, Reggae, Salute to the Beatles, and it's all these Beatles covers they did.
I have my dad's vinyl Peter Tosh collection.
Really? Shit!
Yeah, that's like, my dad, like, has all these, like, classical records.
Yeah.
Like, Handel, Stravinsky, all this stuff, and then there was Peter Tosh.
And there was, in amongst all that was Legalize It.
Yeah, I know, it was just so funny. Like, my dad hates, like, the only, like, rock, like, pop music he had was ZZ Top, like Fandango and Rio Grande Mud, and then some Peter Tosh records, and a couple of Lynyrd Skynyrd albums too.
Of course, you got some Skynyrd, man.
Yeah, but my dad, like, hated rock music, hated all that stuff, but he loved reggae for some reason. Like, he like when the Bob Marley documentary came out, he watched it with me, and he was like, "Yeah, Bob Marley's probably not morally my kind of person, but I love his music." You know,
yeah.
Like, my dad likes reggae. My dad is, like, the most conservative person in the world. You know, like, and very Catholic conservative.
Yeah, and just a bit of interest as well, a bit of a tidbit for listeners out there, that one of the black pickpockets in the film was actually Winston Humphrey's father was in this one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Amazing. Good old Winston Humphrey, friend of the show.
Friend of the show. Our manager, actually. He's like our Charlie, and we're his angels.
But Winston has asked us, though, whenever you bring him up, do not call the Kingston police.
No.
The funny thing is, you mentioned your dad being conservative and listening to reggae, but the odd thing is, Rastafarians are, like, some of the most conservative people you'll ever meet. Aside from the weed, they're extremely, like, conservative. They'd be considered right wing.
Well, you know what's funny though is like the Rastafarians, like not really exactly what you would call women's rights types.
No.
And it's just so funny because I see all these like super leftist women on my Facebook, mm-hmm. and they post stuff like a quote from Bob Marley saying like, "The biggest coward is a man who takes a woman's love without any intention of returning it." And I'm like, gee, who does that sound like?
Winston.
Bob Marley?
Yeah.
You know, that guy had side bitches coming out of his ass.
He was like fucking like Miss Jamaica. Like, he had her in a fuck pad or whatever.
Wow.
And what's so funny is you watch the Bob Marley documentary and they talk to his wife about it. And it's like, and his side women, they're like, "Oh, it's just Bob, you know."
Yeah, just accepted it.
I was like, no, that's called abuse. You know?
Yeah, I got more cat than a veterinarian when he was
like he's sharing the Bob Marley quote. They're like, "So true," and I'm
"Well, have you ever heard the
Bob,
black
Bob would have fucked you and then someone else like in the same night?"
Well, have you ever heard like the Black Uhuru song "Abortion"? It's an anti-abortion song, and it's just crazy to listen to.
Really?
Well, and like the Rastafarians are that's like a strange offshoot. It's like a strange Bible cult.
Yeah, it is.
Like because my dad talks about it. Because my dad like knows a lot about all these like strange offshoots. Like he said, like you know. The Jehovah's Witnesses, the Rastafarians, there are all these like offshoots of Christianity
mm-hmm.
that take specific passages of the Bible out of context and run with them.
Yes.
Like was it the Jehovah's Witnesses, it'll say like it says something about blood and say they go, "Well, no blood transfusions, guys."
Yeah.
Because of course back in the day they were thinking about blood transfusions when they wrote the Bible. But and you know the
you get a blood transfusion, you wake up stoned.
I mean, yeah, like and the Rastafarians, there's something about the root, or there's something that they took out of the Bible that they interpreted as smoke weed all the time.
Right, and they're also
and so like
take the root of the earth.
Yeah, no, it was like the root of the earth or something, and they were like. Yeah. Oh, it's the source of our life, man. You know.
Yeah, a lot of their stuff is Mark of the Beast and all these different references.
They thought Selassie was the king of Nigeria or whatever was the reincarnation of Jesus.
Yeah, he was the new Messiah.
Yeah, that so like it's this weird Christian cult where they thought like this king in Africa was this reincarnation of Christ. So like I don't know if you listen to Bad Brains. You'll get an earful. Like, all you have to do is listen to the Bad Brains, and you will be an expert on that religion.
Oh, that Bad Brains! It's funny. They're sort of rise. It looked like they were going to be the biggest punk band ever because they were doing so well on the American Underground, and they stayed with some gay punkers in Dallas, who apparently were not aware that Rastafarians absolutely hate.
Oh, the Bad Brains had a song called "Don't Blow Bubbles." That's an anti-gay song,
right? Yeah,
like it's full Jesus. On. Like it's like "Don't blow fudge bombs." It's like a song about how gay people spread AIDS and.
Yeah, wow. That stuff basically killed their rise in the punk underground.
Yeah, because with the Quickness could have been a pretty. It had like some expensive videos and stuff, but it had that anti-gay song on it.
Right, and then the you know the gay punkers were becoming a big force underground and everything. So it's just the political correctness of punk. That was around the time that punk was getting real politically correct with Fugazi and all that nonsense. So.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and you weren't gonna have much else.
Which it's kind of funny that Typo Negative like has a song that's pretty full on in the anti-gay department. It's called "I Like Goyles."
Oh,
and it was basically because Peter Steele posed in Playgirl, and stupidly he didn't understand that Playgirl is mostly read by gay men.
Exactly. Yeah,
and so he got this gay following that he didn't want, and so. On the second to last album they made, "Life Is Killing Me," he has a song called "I Like Goyles," and it's a really rocking song. When you hear it, it's like, oh, this is like, you know, it's fast, it's fun. Then you hear it, it's like the lyrics are like, "Look, I'm flattered that you think I'm cute, but I don't deal well with compacted poop."
be one of the few rock and songs they got. They're one of the most boring as fuck bands on the planet. I can't stand them.
I hate them because a place where I work, the DJ was very
a long. Strip club.
Yeah. I had to hear that shit every night.
I you know, the last two Type O albums are more rockin', you know, like the like you have the you know, Bloody Kisses and and October Rust, which are very gothic.
Oh, shit.
You know, once you get to World Coming Down, like, and I love those records, but you get to World Coming Down, you get to Life Is Killing Me, and an album I think is great, Dead Again. It kind of gets back a little close. It's the album. The songs are faster. They're more, you know, rocket. Well, like World Coming Down is a little Black Sabbath-ier, but it's less heavy on the synths and the gothiness.
I can't listen. I'd flash back to extremely long shifts wearing a tuxedo, smoking cigarettes, standing by a door and checking IDs with a flashlight.
Oh, God.
And having to hold my mag light like a fucking baton that I can pop somebody's skull with. You know, and I'm kicking them, asking them to leave the club. You know,
where was this in?
Oh, a long time ago.
Now, where?
It was in Jackson, Mississippi.
Oh,
of course it was.
It's nowhere else.
The South has the like. Every time a film client would come in when I lived in Memphis, they'd want to go to strip clubs because they heard the South had the best strip clubs.
Could have fooled me, but I never did any comparison.
Apparently, in Memphis, in like the 90s, the strip clubs were amazing. Mm-hmm. But by the time these people were coming in, you know, you couldn't even show tits.
Right.
So, you know, they were always disappointed, but I would be like, oh, look, buddy, you know, I don't know if somebody told you that like 5-10 years ago, not anymore.
Yeah.
Anyway, my rating for Rude Boy, since we've fucking gone way off track, is a 10. It could be nothing less than a 10.
Look at that.
Because I think it's a fucking, masterpiece. I think it's an absolute fucking masterpiece, this film. I really do.
I wouldn't call it a masterpiece, but I would call it like a really essential document for anybody who's a fan of punk or like The Clash or anything. Like, I think it's like a must-own, you know.
I know, but
you like The Clash, you absolutely have to see.
Like, that's why I like, because I like The Clash, and it like reignited my love of The Clash. Like, I'm going back and listening to my Clash
album. The thing is, it's not so much The Clash music that I give it a 10 for. It's the other stuff. I mean, remember, I grew up with a British father, so a lot of this talk, like these rhyming slang was not foreign to me. It was stuff I knew anyway. So,
By the way, if you're friends with Stuart on Facebook, occasionally you could see him and his dad getting into arguments on politics on Facebook.
Yeah, since I've switched to
it's hilarious because I look at it and I have no idea what they're saying.
I do. Yeah, that was the Australia Day. I meant to ring my dad on Australia Day. I thought, nah, better not now. He's not happy.
Like, Stuart's like, oi, the socialists are ruining this country. And he's like, oi, Stuart, you're a you're a white wing fuck.
I didn't quite say that, but he may as well have.
He didn't say that, but it was like,
believe me, had I rang him up that night, he would have said, he goes, you fucking turn to the right, you fascist bastard.
You fascist bastard, I'm Labour till death.
Yeah. Doesn't matter, man. Tony Abbott's days are numbered now, according to the news this morning. He's time's up.
Last night, as I was watching this, I tweeted. I said, I'm watching Rude Boy, the film about The Clash. I don't know what language they're speaking. It's allegedly English. Because there's so much slang. I was just like, oh, fuck.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. Leg it. Yeah.
Watching like an early Alex Cox film when I was watching.
Yeah. It was pretty extreme.
So, yeah, especially like when they had Top ahead and he was kicking the, Ray's holding the punching bag and Top was kicking. He's just like, yeah, if you don't know, like I knew it because I said, you know, growing up with a British father, but, a couple of Panda cars, Black Mariah's, like stuff that I knew, but if you didn't grow up around that, you didn't know shit of what they told me. You had to sort of work it out for yourself.
I've heard some of those terms and songs, but I didn't know what the fuck they
meant. Yeah. So that's the thing. This is a very British film, but I think it's fucking outstanding. And I can't give it nothing less than a 10. And also because I've seen it more times than you guys, and maybe because I connect with it in one way, and because I'm seeing more as I watch it each time. But that's just me as well. And mine's not based strictly on the music of The Clash as well. That's there, and I think it's outstanding. But it's more the plots to go with it as well. You know, like this journey we take with
whenever
Ray.
Whenever I heard, like... I'll just say whenever I heard slang that I didn't quite understand, I just assumed it was, like, a reference to a Super Marionation show.
I will say, when I watched it, I went, this is more British than a Peter Gabriel-era Genesis concert.
I was like, okay, that's probably Captain Scarlet. Maybe they're talking about Joe 90. I don't know.
Yeah. Fireball XL5. That was my favorite. Yes! Jerry Anderson one. Absolutely
Stingray,
love.
Stingray. You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Fireball XL5. I'll never forget that show. Getting hammered drunk one night and being so fucking wasted. The next day, just sleeping on the couch with a Fireball XL5 playing on the TV all day. I remember that one quite vividly.
That's what I used to do. I would get drunk, but I'd have to get up early for the newspaper job, and I would watch like the Super Baradation shows like Stingray and Captain Scarlet on the Sci-Fi Channel in the morning.
I do like Stingray as well. I think Stingray was a lot of fun. Stingray!
Troy Tempest is a fucking man.
That's it. Yeah.
He's got a mark.
I made the horrible fucking mistake one day of getting so drunk on fucking Zambuca and getting home at like about 3:30 in the morning, this flicking the TV on, and first thing, yeah, Doctor Who. The opening of Doctor Who. Like all that, oh God. And it made me actually throw up in a toilet because I couldn't stand watching it. Not that I thought Doctor Who was bad, but the actual, just the opening of with all the space and the stars, I'm like, okay, fuck,
the tunnel,
I'm gone.
The tunnel.
And I see some cheap-ass robot, I'm like, fuck this. And I just went, just chundered my guts up for fucking ages after that. Anyway, I think you should go watch Rude Boy, everybody. Where are you going to find it? Okay, you can buy the DVD in the US, which does say it runs 133 minutes. That is the uncut version. There's the PAL DVD from the UK, which is still available, which runs 127 minutes. Don't fear, it's not cut. It's the same thing. It's just the PAL speed-up times are different, but it is the same movie. And for those of you lucky enough in Australia, where I'm at, and you're in Melbourne, you can go to Dirt Cheap. I think they're called Dirt Cheap CDs. I think that guy there still may have them floating around for $5 or $10. If it's there, just get it. Trust me, you won't be disappointed. Whether you find the story intriguing or to your liking, won't really matter because the performances are so great. But I will say this. I really did like Ray in this film, you know. For all the abuse that he copped, I was kind of endeared to Ray. He's a sort of... Some sort of quality about him is like, you know, he's lonely. I mean, there's no doubt he's like a lonely individual. You can see it. I think nothing typifies loneliness more with him than it does with that scene with Joe towards the end where Strummer's at the piano and Ray's just dancing by himself to Let the Good Times Roll.
That old time rock and roll.
Let the Good Times Roll, yeah. Whatever it was, yeah, I forgot the track that Strummer was singing. And
Let that old time rock and roll.
Oh, God. Why do we have to reference Bob Seger in this fucking show? Hate Bob Seger.
It's that old time rockin', bro.
I wish fucking someone would be Bob Seger as Silver Bullet. He looks like a fucking werewolf. Yeah, looks like a werewolf.
I only like the Bob Seger system. Like his 60s stuff, and then after that I can't.
Oh, you would, wouldn't you?
No, the Bob Seger system stuff is great.
Oh, really?
Like, okay. If you hear that, it's a different band. And that stuff wasn't on CD for years, and I don't think it still is.
Oh, really?
Like, up to about Smokin' Ops, he's great, and then he became this pretentious, like, basically the Eagles of Detroit.
What album did he do Rosalie on?
That was like, oh God, it wasn't Against the Wind, but it was like somewhere around the Night Moves era. That's when I can't stand him. I don't like that 70s, like, you know, yacht cocaine rock stuff.
I do like Thin Lizzy's version of Rosalie on Live and Dangerous, though. Well, that was pretty
good. No, that's because Thin Lizzy's awesome.
Yeah. You know, well, that is true. Yeah.
Seeger forgot how to rock in the 70s, in my opinion.
Okay, well, let's wrap it up. Next week, finally, episode 100 for us.
Oh, God.
Yeah, even though your iTunes feed, if those of you who have been following us from pretty much the start or have downloaded all the episodes that are on the feed, will go 100. You're into like 100 and something 106, 107. Yeah, that's because there's a few on there. Ozploy Nations, Netflix Roulette. There was a repost of Iron Age. Yeah. They don't really count as... I mean, yeah, they count, but they don't count in the sort of pantheon of episodes that we've got. So we're going to do...
They're not canonical.
No. Yeah. No. Man. So we got some ideas that we're going to toss around between each other, what we're going to do, but we're not going to be reviewing any films that episode. We're going to be Little River Band said, walking through the park and reminiscing. Probably do a bit of that. All right.
They play fairs here.
Little River Band? Well, this is still playing, yeah,
they play. They play like casinos and fairs.
Yeah.
LRB.
Yeah. All right. Okay. All right. So anyway, we're going to get to episode 100 next week, and we're going to do something with it. We'll sign off. So watch Rude Boy. Track it down. Watch it. Don't look for it on YouTube, you cheap bastards, because it's not there. Go buy it and watch it, or rent it out if you can somewhere. So sign off, lads.
Worth it.
Adios.
Mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? Visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time.
Thank you.